Our topic this evening, dear friends, is walking with God. And our text is found in the third chapter of the prophecy of Amos, the third chapter and the third verse, which reads, "Can two walk together except they be agreed?" This text, these words, are addressed to natural Israel. In the immediate context of these words, God is calling Israel's attention to the fact that they had not been faithful in their obedience to him. He reminds them, however, that he had been faithful to them. "You only have I known," God tells them, "you only have I known of all the families of the earth." He had not divided his affections nor his attention. He had entered into a covenant with them, and he had kept his part of that covenant, but they had not kept their covenant. And because they had not kept their covenant, they had not walked very faithfully with him. Because they had not kept their covenant, they had not been in agreement with him. Their hearts, their minds, were not fully in harmony with him. Therefore, they could not properly walk together with him. Now, of course, we realize that the principle of this text applies to human relationships. We, as the Lord's people, cannot walk together, that is, with any degree of success or blessing, unless we are in a large measure of agreement. But the words of our text is not concerned particularly with the relationship of one human being to another, nor even with the relationship of one Christian to another, or one group of Christians to another group of Christians. It's talking about the matter of the Lord's people walking with him, pointing out that the only way in which his people can walk together with him is upon the basis of their being in agreement with him. Now, as far as we are concerned, we describe that same principle as that of full consecration to do God's will. Not only the profession of a consecration, not only the actual making of a consecration at some certain moment of our lives which is past, but the matter also of carrying out the terms of that consecration. The matter of having our every thought and word and deed in full subjection to his will. The matter of proving that good and acceptable and perfect will of God, and then delighting in our hearts to do that will. The scriptures tell us of a number of individuals who walked with God. That very expression is used in connection with with Enoch. In the fifth chapter of the Genesis, verses 22 and 24, we are told that Enoch walked with God. The scriptures do not tell us a great deal about Enoch. This is one of the expressions. But in the book of Jude in the New Testament, we do have a fragment of information concerning Enoch, a statement which throws a little light on Enoch's walk with God, and it is, to me, very interesting. It says that Enoch prophesied concerning the coming of the Lord with myriads of his saints to execute judgment. Now, this is about the only statement of Scripture which we have which tells us anything of Enoch's activities, of what was involved in Enoch's walk with God. And what it reveals is that Enoch had a measure of knowledge concerning God's future purposes toward mankind, and that he was faithful in bearing witness to the truth as he knew it in his day. And this, apparently, is what constituted his walk with God. We are also told in the book of Genesis that Noah walked with God. This statement is made in the sixth chapter of Genesis and the ninth verse, that Noah walked with God. Now we know a little more about Noah than we do about Enoch. And what we know about this faithful patriarch bears out the same conclusion, namely that his walk with God consisted of his hearty, his enthusiastic response, the response of his heart and of his whole life to the vision of truth which God gave to him. God appeared to Noah and told him of the coming flood, told him of the end of the world that was near, told him, in other words, revealed to him a great dispensational truth, and revealed to him also that there was something which he had to do about it. Noah, in response to this vision of truth, became a preacher of righteousness. And this was, or constituted, a part of his walk with God. Noah also was commissioned by God to build an ark. And Noah's walk with God would have ended at once had Noah refused to build that ark. All of his devotion, all of the possible praying that he could have done, all of his professions, all of everything that was good about him, his righteousness, his moral integrity, his everything important, though they may have been, would not constituted walking with God had Noah turned aside and said, "We'll let someone else build the ark." In order for Noah to walk with God, it was absolutely essential that he be in agreement with God. That this agreement be one of the heart, one which would cause him to respond to every inkling of God's will, respond in terms of toil and sacrifice and ignominy and shame, which undoubtedly must have been heaped upon him when he was building that ark on dry ground and it had never rained. We come down the line a little further to the days of Abraham. And while the scriptures do not use this same term, walking with God, in connection with Abraham, yet we are confident that Abraham did walk with God. The scriptures do tell us that Abraham, because of his faith and obedience, was a friend of God, and I believe that God walks with his friends, don't you? And what constituted Abraham's walk with God? It was the same thing, friends, that constituted Enoch's walk with God and Noah's walk with God. It was his response, his heart response, and the response of his whole being and with everything that he had to the message of truth which God gave to him. The message of truth in Abraham's day became more comprehensive, became more understandable, more full of meaning for Abraham and for the whole world than it had ever been before. Way back in the Garden of Eden, God had said that the seed of the woman would bruise the serpent's head, but that, apart from other scriptures, didn't convey a very clear meaning. But with Abraham, it was quite different. To Abraham, God said that through his seed, all the families of the earth would be blessed. That was understandable. That had a meaning to it. But at the same time, associated with that marvelous revelation of God's purpose, there came the call to walk with God, the call to obedience, the call to consecration, the test as to whether Abraham in his heart and his mind and with his life was in agreement with God, was willing to walk along with him. And Paul tells us in the 11th chapter of Hebrews that Abraham met that test. We are told by the apostle in the 11th chapter of Hebrews that when this call of God came to Abraham, the call that was associated with the promise to leave his own people and his father's house and to go into a land which God would show him, what did he do? He obeyed. He proved that he was in agreement with God and would go along with him despite its cost. And it was costly, as we know. We come to the case of Moses. Moses also walked with God when finally the revelation of God's will to him became clear, and he received the assurance from God of the necessary help and assistance in every time of need. Moses had always been interested in God's people. He had always apparently had a measure of faith in the promises of God. He always had it in his heart to do what God wanted him to do. His interest toward his people, toward his brethren, was manifested in his slaying of an Egyptian that was overriding the rights of his people, as he thought. Moses, on account of this incident, found it necessary to flee from Egypt, as we know. And there was a marking of time, but doubtless down in his heart, there was still that desire, that longing for God, that desire to know more about God and his plans, that was engendered by his faith in the promises of God. But despite the spirit of devotion, despite the fact that he would rather leave the courts of Egypt and take his stand on God's side and in harmony with his promises, Moses was not walking with God during all that 40 years. Moses was not walking with God when he fled from Egypt. Moses' walk with God began only when God spoke to him at the burning bush. And there it was that God revealed to Abraham, or rather to Moses, what his will for him really was. It was there that God gave him his commission. Moses, while probably at heart in agreement with this plan, while at heart doubtless rejoiced in the very thought of the deliverance of his people, nevertheless felt his weakness and desired to resign from the responsibilities of this commission. But God was patient with him, and God assured him that he would supply the needs which he felt that he lacked. And after he was convinced that this was really God's commission for him and that God would stand back of him, what did Moses do? He began to walk with God. He began to walk with God through obedience to the commission. And think what that walk with God cost Moses. Now, if Moses had finally decided, after all the pleading and all the assurances, that he would not accept this commission, that he would just be one of the Israelites, he'd share in the deliverance, he would rejoice in the freedom, and he'd try to go along with them into the desert if he could, but let someone else take the responsibility. Do you suppose that he would be walking with God? No. He would not be in agreement with God. The whole nation of Israel had the opportunity of walking with God on the basis of being in agreement with him. There's a very interesting thought in this connection brought to light in the Hebrew word that is translated agreed in our text. How can two walk together unless they be agreed? That Hebrew word, which is here translated agreed, is one which is used almost exclusively in the Old Testament to describe joint action on the part of God's people in their obedience to him. An example of this is found in Numbers, the 10th chapter and the 3rd verse. Here, God is giving instructions to Moses concerning the use of certain silver trumpets, that on certain occasions, two of these silver trumpets were to be blown, and that the blowing of these silver trumpets was to be the signal for an assembly of all the camp of Israel at the door of the tabernacle. And the word assemble in this text, in these instructions, is translated from the same Hebrew word as is translated agreed in our text. This indicates that when this silver trumpet was blown, if the people of Israel wanted to walk together with God, they had to agree upon joint action and be at the door of the tabernacle. Otherwise, they would not be in agreement with themselves and with God and with their covenant, and would not be walking with him. And so it is, dear friends, we find in the further study of this particular word in the Old Testament and the study of the principle involved throughout the entire Scriptures that joint action on the part of God's people often has been the condition of walking with God. Walking with God is not a matter of individual choice or a matter of suiting our own preferences as individuals. In the development of the plan of God, from generation to generation and from age to age, there are important crisis periods, important steps forward in that plan when God gives marvelous demonstrations of truth, when the silver tones of truth are sounded out upon these trumpets of God, these symbolic trumpets of God, and those who wish to walk with God must respond to those silver tones of truth if they want to be in agreement with Him. Those who say, well, I'll think this matter over. I'll not go up with the rest of the Lord's people. I'll stand on the sidelines. I'll be an individualist. I'll be an isolationist. I'll stand on my own feet. They will not walk with God, because God doesn't walk with those, with His people, except as they walk jointly together. In the 11th chapter of Hebrews, we are given a whole array of faithful servants of God of the Old Testament period, all of whom, without doubt, walked with God upon the basis of their obedience, their faithfulness to the word of truth, God's word, as they came to them. And in the 12th chapter of Hebrews, these are referred to as a great cloud of witnesses. Seeing that we are encompassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, says the apostle, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and the finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before Him endured the cross and despised the shame. And so we come down now to the case of Jesus, to the time of Jesus, and note the manner in which He walked with God. At the time of our first, our Lord's first advent, there was an important step forward in the plan of God. Here was a turning of an age. Here was the ending of the Jewish age, and here was the beginning of the gospel age. Here was the first advent of Jesus and the period of His presence and the marvelous work which He accomplished. But we get a little idea of what it meant for Jesus to walk with God when we note some points in connection with His consecration and the spirit of His consecration. He knew, apparently, in His heart that He was in the world. He had come to earth upon a special mission, that there was a great work for Him to do. But He didn't go about that service. He didn't attempt to embark on some great enterprise independently. No, He first came to God, and the spirit of His consecration is beautifully and clearly set forth by the psalmist in those words, lo, I come to do Thy will, O God, as it is written of me in the volume of the book. In these words, we find that Jesus saying, in effect, that He wanted to be in agreement with His Heavenly Father. And upon the basis of this agreement, to walk with Him. We see this exemplified in the Master's life throughout His ministry. At every turn of the road, as it were, upon every suitable occasion, He reminds us in His teachings, in His parables, in connection with His ministry, that all that He was doing that all that he was saying, that his whole outlook on life was that which came to him from God. The works which I do, they are not my works. The words which I speak, they are not my words. And because Jesus spoke the words of his Father, the words which the Father gave to him, and because he did the work which God commissioned him and empowered him to do, Jesus walked with God. Because he was in agreement with God. But Jesus walked with God led him to death. It was God's will for him to die. And so it is, friends, with all who walk with God in this gospel age. There is no other way to walk with God but to walk in the way of death with Jesus. I often wonder, friends, in connection with myself, and I have no doubt but what this question often arises in your mind, as to how well and thoroughly and sincerely we take this viewpoint into consideration. It seems that in our struggle against the flesh is running the show most of the time. That most of the time we are considering our own welfare, our own comfort, our own pleasure. How we can enjoy this and enjoy that, and whether we like this or like that, or whether this is best for us or that is best for us. It seems to me, in my own case, that that is true about 95% of the time. And once in a while, we take into consideration, is this God's will? That's true almost all the way along. Isn't it? Well, perhaps you've got along better in the narrow way than I have. I'll just say that about myself. But friends, that's not the way to walk with God. That's not the way that Jesus walked with God. Peter was one who ultimately learned how to walk with God. But Peter, for a long time, expressed to Jesus and to others the human viewpoint, the viewpoint, friends, which too often is our viewpoint. When Jesus announced that in his walk with God, he was going up to Jerusalem, where he expected to be arrested and put to death, Peter said, "Be this thing far from thee, Lord." But Jesus said, "Thou savorest the things that be of man." Your viewpoint is all right. So far as worldly wisdom is concerned, worldly wisdom always thinks it's advisable to take self into consideration, not to do what is called a foolhardy thing. That's all right, Peter, but I'm walking with God. And I'm in agreement with God, and God's arrangement for me is that I am to die as the world's redeemer. And if I am to walk with God, I must now walk up to Jerusalem and die. Friends, are we willing to go up to Jerusalem for the sake of truth, for the sake of being in agreement with God, for the sake of carrying out the terms of our consecration. Peter learned better than this after a while. The thing which stirred Peter, the thing which caused him to be all wrought up, no doubt with righteous indignation, was the fact that Jesus, as a righteous man, which he knew him to be, would suffer unjustly at Jerusalem. Why should this man, who had done nothing else in his life but good, who'd gone up and down the country doing good, healing the sick, raising the dead, preaching glad tidings of great joy, why should they take him and crucify him? You can get Peter's viewpoint, but after Peter was converted, as Jesus said he would be, and in obedience to his commission to strengthen the brethren, as Jesus said he would be commissioned to do, Peter said, happy, what glory is it if we do evil and suffer for it? Even if, friends, we do wrong and suffer for it, and recognize in our suffering that this is a just retribution, that the Lord is chastising us, and we accept that and we say, well, I'm glad the Lord is dealing with us, and so on, and we can get above that situation. Even if we are successful to that extent, it's nothing to glory in. But Peter said, if we do good and suffer for it, happy are we. If we can do good and suffer for it, happy are we. And that's what it takes, friends, to walk with God. That's what it takes, let me repeat, to walk with God. And Peter learned how to walk with God. Paul learned how to walk with God. Let's think of the zeal, the righteousness according to the law, the zeal of Saul of Tarsus in doing that which he thought God wanted him to do. But in all of that zeal to stamp out what he considered to be heresy in the earth and especially among the people of Israel, Paul was not walking with God. God had no idea of saying or implying that Paul's sincerity constituted a walk with God. There's never been a more subtle error suggested to the people of God that the only thing that counts in the Christian life is sincerity. We can't be faithful Christians without being sincere, but friends, we have to be more than sincere. Paul was sincere, but he was not walking with God. He was not walking with God until on the road to Damascus, God revealed the truth to him. And in response to that wonderful vision of truth, Paul said, what wilt thou have me to do? I want to be in agreement with you. I want to walk with you. What is your will for me? And when the answer came to that question through Ananias, Paul had pointed out to him, to begin with, not the joys of the Christian life, of which there are so many. Oh, haven't we enjoyed ourselves at this convention? Not even the rain of 2 days could mar that happiness, that joy. But friends, Paul or Saul of Tarsus did not, to begin with, have the joys of the Christian life pointed out to him. When Ananias was told to go and tell Paul what great things he must suffer in the name of Christ. I often think, friends, how fortunate it is with most of us, because it is true with most of us, that God does not, at the beginning, reveal the sufferings of the narrow way. That as a rule, we are led to consecration by the sheer joys of the truth and our love for God. Oh, we know, to begin with, that it is a narrow way. But if we knew right from the start all the difficulties of the way and did not have revealed to us some of the joys of the way, I wonder how many of us would have made a consecration. Oh, God is merciful in this and knows how to lead us to consecration. He knows how to lead each one of us. But he knew Paul, too. He knew Paul's sincerity. Oh, his sincerity was important. He knew that Paul was of the stamp and character that no matter what he told him would be involved, he would obey. He would be in agreement with him. So to Ananias, God said, go tell this man what great things he must suffer and what great things he did suffer in his walk with God. He had his joys, but friends, he had a narrow way in which to walk, a way which was fraught with suffering, mentally and physically, at almost every step of the way, and ended up in prison in Rome, where finally he was beheaded with the knowledge that many of the churches, many of the brethren that had received the truth through his ministry and who rejoiced with him in the days of joy, went back on him, failed him in his hour of greatest need, when only God stood by. But God stood by because he was walking with God. We have wonderful exhibitions of faithfulness in walking with God in the early church. But with the death of the apostles, there came for many hundreds of years, to a large extent, a marking of time. Oh, there were faithful individuals down through the age. Church history reveals one here and there. Not those who are glorified in Catholic literature, however. I doubt if they were Christians. But those who were considered heretics in the various generations, there were a few of those who walked with God, a few of those who rejoiced in the promises of God. I'll tell you who one of those was. It was Sir Isaac Newton. I confidently believe that Newton walked with God. I want to tell you a little story about him. Some years ago, in the city of Philadelphia, I think it was in the paper known as the Philadelphia Inquirer, one of the paper's columnists was writing up a series of articles, the theme of which was calculated to point out that most of the great individuals, the great characters of history, were great only in one thing. That when they branched out from that in which they were specialists and in which they were proficient, they usually made fools of themselves. And so one of the historical characters discussed in this series of articles was Sir Isaac Newton. The article went on to show what a great mathematician he was, what a great scientist he was, what a great astronomer he was, and so on, his greatness along those lines. But this columnist wrote, when you examine Newton's religious writing, when he got into the fields of religion, his writings remind us almost entirely of Russellism. And that was pretty bad. Yes, friends, Newton walked with God. And there were others who walked with God. But to a large extent, throughout that entire period, there was a marking of time, a holding on to the visions of truth that had been given and had been recorded in the Bible through the prophets and the apostles. But there came a time, friends, our time, the end of the age, when the plan of God was due to take another step forward. The time when another great revelation of truth was due. A time when God would again speak to his people and give them a special commission. And with the beginning of that time, and through all the years since, even today, and still today, friends, those who would walk with God must be in agreement with those silver tones of truth. They must be in agreement with God in connection with this great program of the end of the age. And being in agreement with God, they will not only walk with him, but they will be in agreement with one another, and they'll walk together as a body of people with God. Let's not mistake this, friends. In the parable of the wheat and the tares, We have this brought to our attention. We have brought to our attention the fact that at the beginning of the age, there would be a sowing of the wheat in the wheat seed. Now, we mustn't confuse this parable with the parable of the sower. In the parable of the sower, the seed that is sown is the truth. This parable conveys its own wonderful lesson. But in the parable of the wheat and the tares, the seed, the wheat seed, is the children of the kingdom. That's what Jesus said. That's the way he explained it. In other words, in this parable, we have an explanation or a statement covering the establishment of the early church with its apostles and other faithful representatives of God and all the believers that were assembled there, who together agreed with the truth then due and agreed with God and walked with him. They were all planted, as it were, as the children of the kingdom, as the wheat of this parable. Following the death of the apostles, the enemy came in and sowed tares. And these tares were the children of the wicked one. They were the false teachers, the false leaders that were brought into the church, some from the Orient, some from paganism, some with this philosophy and that philosophy, and they began through their false teaching to distort and to twist the truth until finally they became responsible for the darkness of the dark ages. And with the darkness of the dark ages came the persecution, came the Holy Inquisition, came the burning at the stake, came all of those atrocities in the name of Jesus, but actually carried on by the authority and under the inspiration of the devil himself. But this parable spans the age. And while the children of the kingdom, according to this parable, were to grow together with the tares, they were to be as individuals standing alone in all that conglomeration of error and false teaching and hypocrites and children of the devil, standing alone as best they could, like Newton did and others. Nevertheless, at the end of the age, something was to happen. At the end of the age, there was to be a harvest. The wheat was to be separated from the tares. And at the end of the age, as Jesus said in this parable, the Lord would say to the reapers, gather the wheat. And this was the commission, like the commission that was given to Noah to build the ark, and to Moses to lead the children of Israel out of Egypt. This was the commission that was given to the people of God, the angels, the reapers of the parable at the end of the age. And those who would walk with God, those who would walk with God once the end of the age was reached and the great harvest truth was made known and trumpeted forth to all the earth